wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora. Hello.
Kia ora.
We're joined in studio here by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. How are you going this morning?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. Actually, it's not the morning. It's literally midday. Yeah. We just finished the morning. Great. You've got three really cool, interesting stories for us today. Maybe we'll get started with this Inca record keeping one. I was having a look. They found something quite interesting here.
Yeah, no, so this is really cool. So a little bit of background first, the Inca Empire. So this was the largest empire in pre-Columbian America. So it basically grew out of the Peruvian highlands in the early 13th century until the Spanish colonized and the last state was conquered in 1572. Now, what's really interesting about this empire is it didn't actually have a system of writing that we recognize as a system of writing. But it had monumental architecture, right? Think of Machu Picchu. It had an extensive road network. It had finely woven textiles. You know, like there was, they manufactured stuff. So it kind of didn't fit with anthropologists way back when they first started discovering about the Incan Empire, kind of what they viewed as how you'd build an empire. Mm-hmm. But what they do have is things called quipu. And these are how they kept their records.
Yeah.
And they're quite amazing. They're basically, it's a cord or like a piece of fiber that you think it would stretch horizontally. And then from that, other pieces of cord and fiber that hang down. They're called the pendant cords.
And they use hair and different things for this, like to make this. What kind of things would they use?
Yeah, so they used hair, which is really important to our story today. Mm-hmm. They used cotton. They used what you would call camelid fiber, which this is basically alpacas and llama fiber and these sort of things.
Yeah.
What's really cool about these things is these fibers, they actually have knots in them, right? And they have different types of knots and they'll have different colors. And so they, with these hanging cords, the knots will appear in different spots and stuff. And this is your record. So these knots tell a story and they give out.
How does that tell a story? Oh,
it doesn't
make sense to me.
And it's kind of one analogy that I saw that was really great was it's like, think of your spreadsheet and you've made it into cords and knots. It sort of thing. And so they actually had the decimal system.
Yeah.
And so you would have a row and that would be your hundreds row. And so you would tie a knot that represent like four. So that was 400. And then you'd have another row and that would be the tens. And so you would tie a knot to represent.
Is it like a timeline or something?
Well, it would depend. So they used it for keeping track of taxes.
Yeah.
Like astronomical calendar, sort of keeping track of that. Keeping census records. Mm-hmm. Keeping track of the grain or, you know, like the stocks. So they found like one site they found where they were and they knew they were keeping chili peppers and other sort of products. So, like it was kind of another nice explanation. It was the accountants of life, right? Mm-hmm. So they were keeping records. There is actually, I was looking at one thing where of the ones that have been found, they would say like about 2/3 are numerical, so they're like these accounting ones. But then there's 1/3 where they think they're more narrative, so that they're telling a story, but we don't know how to read it.
Whoa.
Like we've still got there's a lot to work out.
That's
still
pretty cool. Yeah. And you said that hair was an important part of this story. Did you want to talk about that?
Yes. We have records from when the Spanish colonized. You know, there's the people that chronicled that, and so they had recorded that. Basically, these quipu were made by these quipu kamamoas. Apology for the pronunciation on that. But that they were male, they were bureaucrats, and they were high status. They were elite. There is an account from an indigenous chronicler from that time that said no, females kept these as well. So this has been a bit of a debate. It's like who could read these, who were making these, because it was also considered that it was the person making them that could read them very well.
Yeah, in that. Right.
And so what this recent study has done is they've looked at one of these quipu that's in that came out of a German auction several years ago that had hair. So what you can do with the hair is actually isotopic analysis. So One of the sad things has been that a lot of these sites were looted over time, and so they've ended up divorced from their provenance, right? We don't know where they came from because someone took them and then they sold them, and so we don't know really where they came.
Yeah, that makes sense. The
case with this one. And so what they've been able to do is radiocarbon dating. So that's when you have carbon 14, it's unstable, and so it decays over time to nitrogen 14. And from this you can get the age of it. So you're quite used to hearing radiocarbon dating. So we know that from that this quipu was made probably about 1498, plus or minus like 30 years.
Yeah, that's pretty specific.
Yeah, but it's the height of the Incan time, and because this is supposed to be quite a spectacular example of one of these quipu. But then what you can do is you look at the stable isotopes. So you look at the carbon in it, you look at the nitrogen, you look at the sulfur, and this can tell you about what that person was eating who it came from. And so what they can tell from the carbon is that this person was eating what's called C13 plants. So these are things like tubers or greens.
Yeah.
They weren't eating things like maize, which we kind of know from other studies was for the elite.
Mm-hmm.
From the nitrogen, we can start to see what sort of that they weren't having a lot of meat. So again, the meat was more for the elite, not so much for the commoners.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wasn't eating fish, like there wasn't really marine food in it. And the sulfur agrees with this. So we start to build up this picture that we have this, whoever's this here came from was more of a commoner, or had a commoner diet, I should say, rather than the diet we'd associate with a high status individual. They were also able to tell that from the hydrogen and oxygen in this, that it was probably from someone who was living higher up, like away from the sea, aligns with the diet.
Yeah.
And so it's a piece of evidence to this idea that, you know, maybe making these things was more widespread than was recorded by the Spanish when they colonized these areas, and that, we still have a lot to learn about these quipu.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It would be cool to find all different kinds of perspectives. I mean, I don't know what really you can find out from these record keeping, especially like the narrative ones, like you said.
But. Yeah, no, and it's one of the really interesting things when like the history intersects with the science, right? And that, like, because you get historical records that people have kept, but they're never completely unbiased in there. Yeah. And so then you kind of like using the science to go to look at the different viewpoints and see what lines up, what doesn't line up.
Yeah,
and
I understand suppose there's better. So many factors in there.
Yeah, and then with understanding what the narrative ones say, I have no idea how you approach that problem. Like, it's mind-boggling.
It's like a whole language, I suppose.
That's exactly, really cool. Right, yeah.
I'll track onto our next topic. You're talking about snails regenerating their eyes. This is a pretty crazy. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. Snails seem like pretty mysterious creatures, but you want to talk about this one a bit?
Yeah, so we kind of already know of some animals that can regenerate limbs and tails and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But eyes is pretty impressive.
That's right? Crazy.
Yeah. And so it's something called a golden apple snail. It's a freshwater snail from Southern America, but it's actually one of the most invasive species on the world. Like, it's been transported a lot of places and it does very well.
Oh, yeah.
We've got some in New Zealand. They're mainly sold in pet shops for aquaria and stuff, but there have been some found in waterways, which you obviously don't want. And you had a group of researchers were like, why does this thing survive so well? So they kind of started studying it more and discovered it can completely grow a new functional eye within months of that eye being amputated.
Wow. How do you find that out? That's an interesting one.
I think they must have had some suspicions, I guess, because someone had to go cut the eye and then just watch what happened.
Yeah, for a few months as well. That's quite a long time for it to take to regenerate, but I suppose that's...
Well, I mean, we can't even transplant eyes.
This is true. I didn't even know snails lived that long, to be honest.
So. Yeah, well, if you look after them. So they basically, if you amputate the eye, within a month you see something that looks like an eye, but they say it's probably about 3 months before it really integrates with the brain and so that you've got vision restored.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really kind of exciting about this as well is that snails have what's called a camera-like eye, which is like what we have as humans, where it's just one chamber, you have a lens, a cornea, and some light-gathering cells at the back of the eye and the retina.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, like if you think of a lot of insects and crustaceans, they have what's called compound eyes. So these have thousands of what you call ommatidia, where there's these tiny independent units that have each have a cornea, a lens, and these light gathering cells.
Okay.
So if you think about a fly, and you know, if you've seen the picture of their eye, where there's lots of
it's pretty buggy.
Yeah, exactly, right. So, you know, so the understanding how these cells regenerate or repair their eyes is actually, it's obviously really exciting to scientists just from a let's find out what's happening, but also the fact that it might lead to therapies for eye injuries or diseases in humans.
So you reckon you can like move or make this useful for humans in some way?
That's kind of one of the motivations for studying this, because some of the genes that influence eye growth and development in the snails are the same as the sort of genes that we have. So it's obviously not going to directly translate, but it's a good model system for us to start learning more about eye development and regeneration. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done with these snails is they've used a system called CRISPR-Cas9, which is basically, you can think of it like molecular scissors. It's a way to edit the genes in an organism or a cell so that you can basically turn genes on or turn genes off. And so in humans and in snails, we have a gene called PAX6 that's actually really important to us, our eye development. So what they did was they basically turned it off and saw, like, just observed what happened. And no eye developed. But the snail kept growing. So obviously they just did this in snails, and they're not doing this in humans. Mm-hmm. And what they found was these eyeless snails, where their eye did not develop, they just sat at the bottom of the tank, they were on their backs, and they did nothing. They didn't go try find food, they didn't try and right themselves, they didn't crawl. And so the researchers would go in and they'd flip the snail back to the right way around so that they could go crawl. Yeah. And they still did nothing. They just didn't. If the researchers fed them, they fed them some lettuce.
Yeah.
The snails would eat. They grew to adulthood. And so what they think is maybe what's happening here is that with turning off that PAX6 gene, yes, it stopped the eye development, but it's also had some effect on brain development as well.
Oh, okay.
And what they've now, like, they're basically breeding lineages of these snails where they've turned off the genes and can start to observe what happens. They also think that maybe with the fact that these snails regenerate their eyes, it's not probably due to one gene. It's probably a bunch of molecular switches that turn on a range of genes at a certain time in a certain place so that you get this regeneration. So now they want to study that to then see if they can identify it in humans, like, so that we can understand that process better. And
if we have the same kind of, like, structure, I suppose. I don't know how that, might be useful at all.
Exactly, right? And so we may not. We have no idea, but that's kind of where this research goes now.
Hopefully we're not too similar to snails, but maybe in the best ways. Our final topic here today is a very nice one for female women's health, I'd say. Did you want to talk about this story?
Yeah, so this is about embryo implantation into the uterine wall. So why are we interested in this? So in reproduction, an egg is fertilized, it becomes what's called a zygote. So the cells start to divide, and then they divide more and they become what's called a blastocyte. So it's just a mass of cells. And at the moment it's still kind of just hanging around. But what has to happen is that blastocyte has to embed into the uterine wall so that then you can get further development. If that doesn't happen, it's basically referred to as a spontaneous abortion. Those cells aren't going to replicate, develop more, and you're not going to become a fetus.
And so this isn't something that you know much about. I didn't realize that this was, I guess, something that was mysterious or, like, not very well known. Is it?
There's been a lot of studies on it, but it's a hard system to study, right? Okay. So because a lot of the studies will focus on, like, the biochemistry or the genetics of it, so what's happening in those processes. But if you can think about it, it's cells that have to attach to the uterine wall and then kind of press in. So it's quite mechanical, and so that's what's not really being studied a lot, is the mechanics of it. Like, how do these cells get in there? Like, is it that there are enzymes that kind of eat away a bit of the wall so that the cell ball can get in, or is it that they kind of really press in, or what's going on? And that's what these researchers, what they've done is, we can't do that in a person at the moment. Like, that's we can't really, that's hard to even conceive for me how do you would study that.
Yeah, it feels invasive.
It would be, yeah. So what they're doing is they've basically developed something that you can use ex vivo, so outside the body, and it's basically a mix of collagen, and which is what a lot of our, the wall of our uterus is mm-hmm. got a lot of collagen, and there's basically protein mix that they've made from human origin to mimic that wall, cell wall. And so what they've been able to do now is use mouse and human embryos to study what happens where if you have this mixture and you just have a layer of it and you put this, these blastocytes on top, what happens? What mm-hmm. is in that? Or if you embed it in, what happens? And then they've been able to change the conditions and start to study what's going on. And by doing this, that means that they can image it in real time. They can start to do some more mechanical testing and stuff. And so it's just, this is kind of, it's a report of a new platform that enables a lot more of these studies so that we can start to understand more. What they did find, that mice and human embryos actually work quite differently. So you kind of go, they're both mammals, they're probably pretty similar in what happens.
Yeah.
Whereas in the mouse, what they kind of saw was they would, when they were put on the surface of so our phantom or our fake uterine wall, they would kind of attach and then they would kind of envelope or fold around them, whereas with the human embryo it kind of more dug in and that, and then the human embryo kind of grew out from all sides, so grew out radially. They found that both processes they were called what's mechanosensitive, so if there was some mechanical change that actually affected how the implantation happened. And so with the uterus has uterine contractions, so you know, like it's moving, so when you think about, you know, when it's happening in their bodies, like that probably has some effect on that implantation process, which is obviously very interesting if people are going through IVF and stuff. And so it's basically, it's a platform that we can learn a lot more about and understand better.
Yeah, it sounds like there'd be some really good benefits from that to learn more about this or have some way to study it more closely,
I
suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much. That's all of our topics for today. I appreciate you coming in for Dear Science for yet another week. Thank you again, Krishla. Thank you to Motat. And thank you, Science. That is the end of the Dear Science segment for today.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.